This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Well, hello everyone. I'm very honoured to be here today with this stellar panel of experts around reporting Islam. Just to explain myself, Denise Ryan Costello, I was a journalist with The Age for 20 years and reported many different rounds. I'm fairly typical of what journalists do in this area. I was a business reporter, politics, health. You tend to cover things for a couple of years. You have to get across them very fast. When it comes to covering topics like reporting Islam, this obviously cuts across every round, and journalists, as a general rule, are not trained particularly well. But what is happening, thankfully, is we have some programs from experienced journalists and individuals in universities that are changing this. So I'd like to introduce our panel. We've got Professor Mark Pearson, who is at Griffith University. He's the head of journalism and social media. And he has launched a project around reporting Islam that is very valuable for any of you here who are journalists and just any of you anyway. It's just a really excellent learning resource. Working with Mark is Dr. Abdi Hirsi, who is the trainer of this program. He's an expert on all things Islam, and he is the project manager. As well, I'm very pleased to see Kot Monua. He is the president of the South Sudanese Community Association. Now, Kot and I met each other when I was a journalist at The Age writing about education, and Kot, who is a lawyer at Slater and Gordon, is also an activist around helping young African Australians stay in education. Kot's story is that as a former refugee, when he was living out in Dandenong, he used to sleep under his desk at Victoria University to get access to a laptop. A computer in the university, because he did not own a laptop. And this time last year, Kot, you and I were working on a story for The Age, trying to get people to donate funds for laptops for young people who right now, because the universities get filled with students' re-exams, would not have access to the university computer. They're fighting with students who actually have a laptop at home but have come into the uni. So Kot's still receiving donations for laptops. A project that's ongoing. Now, Kot, we wrote about a lot of different serious stories together. He was a major resource around violence and racism, and he will tell you a bit more about that. So he's not necessarily, he's a Christian from South Sudan, he's very familiar with the principles around Islam, but he is also concerned about the reporting of diverse communities. And so a lot of the wonderful work done by Mark and Abdi is equally applicable to reporting other communities. At Swinburne University, where I now work, we have incorporated a new element called reporting diverse communities into our specialist reporting program. So the universities are starting to train journalists in this area, and hopefully we can also get this out into the newsrooms. So I'm going to ask Mark, first of all, to talk about this unique project and perhaps how we do get all that good work you've done into the newsrooms.
Okay, well, welcome everybody. And it's great to see non-horse racing enthusiasts along for a reporting Islam session. I understand, I've got nothing against horse racing enthusiasts, but I understand they'd be otherwise occupied at this time in Melbourne. So thanks for coming along, and thanks to those who did just attend over the last couple of hours our Reporting Islam workshop, where we've workshopped some of our materials. My colleague, Dr. Abdi Hirsi, is the Islam and Muslim expert from our project, so he'll talk more about that area. My own expertise is more in journalism education and journalism law and ethics. And clearly there's a lot of ethics and some law associated with this space, the reporting of Islam by the mainstream media. So our own project, the Reporting Islam Project, is into its third year of funding now, just now. We've just started that third stage this financial year. It's funded, the funding originates from the Commonwealth Attorney General's Office, and our client that that deals with us is the Queensland Police Service, which might sound a little bit strange for an ethics project. But the Commonwealth authorities' concern that sensationalised and Islamophobic coverage of Islam by the mainstream media actually plays into the hands of extremist groups and actually alienates and isolates people in the Muslim community. And a lot of the research actually shows that those who follow that path are people who have become alienated and isolated from the community, as we've seen. I think we're going to talk a little bit later about the Age's front page story today. So that's one element of the project, but as a starting point, being a journalist myself and a law and ethics person, the starting point in launching a major project which includes resources and training curricula for working journalists and for journalism students, the starting point is that nothing you should do with such a project should stand in the way of them actually reporting real news that is happening in their communities. And we can't deny the fact that if a mosque proposal is there before a local council and there are X number of people marching down the main street of town in protest against that, we can't deny that that's an important story for the community. And it needs to be reported. Our audiences would demand that be reported, and they'd be asking various serious questions if it was not reported. The question is how it is reported, and how can it be reported in a way that is inclusive of all of the important voices related to such a story, informative and accurate, basic journalism 101, how do we cover something fairly and accurately, and perhaps even offer or call for and canvas certain solutions that might actually help heal wounds in a community rather than exacerbate or inflame community tensions. And that's a tall order, but that's our aim in this project. What we've found in the first stage of the project in accessing the international literature in this space was that there were common problems that were hallmarks of poor reporting practice in this area. And apart from the inaccuracy, these common problems were things like conflating big issues like terrorism and Islam into a single story and always looking at Islam and Muslim communities through that lens of something negative in the community. Another thing really important was the viewing of Muslim communities as a whole amorphous group rather than, and perhaps just seeking out a single spokesperson that isn't necessarily representative of the diversity of opinions and people and cultural and national backgrounds in those communities. And of course, other key issues were that the framing of certain stories, particularly if they were red flag type or hot button stories, seemed to follow just a single-minded, almost stereotypical approach. So if it was a terror arrest or a mosque opening or a debate over halal food or whatever, it seemed to follow the same little framing pattern. So what have we developed? I mean, the stage two of our project last year was to develop prototypes of various resources. We've developed an app for mobile devices, which has a lot of tips and guidelines for journalists in this area, the voices of experts, people who've been impacted by poor media reporting, people who have been alienated and isolated, academic experts from a range of disciplines talking about those sorts of phenomena. A welcome message from the journalist Peter Grester, who had many years reporting in that area. and a handbook of materials, a website based around that, and two curricula and training guides for workshops based around the reporting of a mosque and a terrorism arrest. And this year of the project, we're rolling those out further, refining those resources, and we're identifying, we've already identified some partners who can take these resources forward to give them sustainability into the longer term rather than just leave them by the wayside as a one-off 2013 to 2016 project. So that's it, but I'll hand you over to the real experts in the space.
All right. Well, I recommend those resources to you, and it really it's just put into Google the words, as I did just before, go to Griffith University website and put in the terms reporting Islam, and up will come these really excellent resources. Also, your workshop is going to be digital, isn't it, Abdi? And Abdi just treated us to a really very interesting and educational session around principles around Islam, and he is the expert. So I'm going to hand over to you now to talk about how you, what the problems are and how you are trying to deal with those.
Well, thank you very much, and I also welcome everybody here. My name is Abdi Hirsi, and I'm the Report on Islam Project Manager. I'm also the Muslim trainer, and just like my colleague Professor Pearson said, you need ethics and understanding the law of reporting. But we also know that you cannot actually report Islam and Muslims very well if you don't actually have the basic knowledge of this religion and its people. And that's where I come into the project. We know from previous studies, and we also conduct our own pre and post quizzes in our workshops, and we know for sure that there is a very low baseline knowledge of Islam and Muslims, and journalists as well actually have a very, very low baseline knowledge of Islam and Muslims. I think nationality studies also show that the society at large also has a very low base knowledge of Islam and Muslims. So the point is, you cannot actually report a topic if you don't actually know the basics of that topic. And Islam is not different to any other topic of reporting. So what we do in the project is we actually incorporated an element of the need to know Islam into our workshop. And that's where what I do when we go around and do these workshops. So, for instance, we try to tell people some very key specific terms and terminologies in Islam and the correct definition is of those terms and terminologies. And I think that's very important because language is one area in which reporting Islam and Muslims is very negative. Terms like jihad, sharia law, halal, and all that actually are reported actually a lot, but with always a very negative definition of what they are. The other thing is we tend to actually, in most of the reportage, conflate Islam and terrorism and a few other things. So in our workshop, is what we talk about is that Islam is not an alien religion. Islam is one of the Abrahamic faith groups. It's not a new religion. It has a lot of similarities. It shares a lot of history with those other great religions. So when you're reporting topics related to Islam and Muslims, you need to actually distinguish an individual Muslim who may have committed something from the great religion of Islam. So that's one other thing we do. Muslims want to be reported. I think the lack of it will be very, very devastating, because if you're not reported, then you will probably lose allocation of resources and other things. You know, as a community, if you're here, you have to be reported. So Muslims are not necessarily against reporting. But when that reporting is inaccurate, unethical, and ignorant, that's where the problem is, and that's where this project actually comes, to actually educate journalists about both the ethics and the law side, in which Professor Pearson is an expert, but also understanding the basics about the religion of Islam and Muslim people.
And Cot, obviously the type of material that's being dealt with here also applies to the reporting of other communities. And I know you have worked very hard, both as the president of the South Sudanese Community Association and as a lawyer and as a person, to actually improve the reporting of your community and of African Australian communities. Can you just tell us about that and also what you see as the issues around the reporting?
Sure, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. Again, thank you for your time and your attendance. With respect to how we see things from our African community and probably maybe South Sudanese community is covered in the media, I probably concurred with my colleagues who have spoken early on. And where we come from is, one is a number of journalists, for example, don't have significant knowledge around Africa as a continent. And it is a diverse country with 55 countries. And out of those 55 countries, there are significant dynamics. Second is there is significant knowledge, again, when it comes to people covering South Sudanese. And often the way it is covered, for example, instead of making specific descriptions and identifiers of an offender or offending party, there seem to be a connotation significantly emphasizing an ethnic origin of that particular individual. For example, when let's say, for example, it is a male Chinese, Greek, or whatever, Italian who has committed an offense, all of that is not descriptive in the media coverage. And whereas if it is an African or a South Sudanese, often you'll find those identifiers. There is no problem probably maybe describing that this is a black African person, a black offender with African heritage or appearance, but a lot of the description goes deeper in terms of how it tends to alienate and probably maybe demonize those communities. And where we tend to find it doesn't sit very well is that a lot of potential and would-be employers, for example, tend to be swayed by all this coverage, and there is significant lack of opportunities. For example, a lot of young people, following Mumba brawls, for example. What happened? The Mumba brawl was quite complex in a way that the many offending parties were of various diverse backgrounds. And it turned out that it was made to be an African or probably a South Sudanese. And there is a significant number of young people who are reeling from that effect and who are also being disadvantaged by employers, because from that moment, a lot of them and a lot of people are being perceived as if they are gang members or probably maybe part of that group, or part of the FX group. So where we come from is, we try to obviously educate the journalists that if you are trying to cover news about an ethnic group or, African, probably maybe you need to, one, be ethical and probably be understanding of how you will write your news. There is no problem in writing your news, but if your news is written in a way or probably aired in a way that it is likely to demonize an ethnic community or an ethnic group, it is rather alienating them rather than helping them integrate in the society. And there are many consequences that follow on from that.
Thanks, Cot. That's certainly been analysed a lot, that coverage recently, the fact that the so-called Apex gang, which was reported in some media as an African or Sudanese gang, is in fact a very a group of young men from very diverse backgrounds. So that's a classic example of poor reporting, generalisations, etc. I wonder, Mark, if you can give us some examples, and then perhaps you, Abdi, of poor reporting that you've witnessed previously.
Well, there's just so much that have come up in our initial literature reviews and so on. The one that really it was emblematic of this stereotypical coverage, which basically slighted the whole religion of Islam, was a story in the Australian newspaper, the Weekend Australian newspaper, a couple of years ago. The story was actually about a former military leader who had become an academic in national security issues And his thesis, or his paper that he was presenting, his speech, spoke about how the current hostilities between Western alliances and certain Middle Eastern countries, that war and the so-called war on terror was likely to go on well into the next century. Now, that thesis was reasonable. I mean, it was an international relations type military assessment. The headline the Australian, the Weekend Australian, chose to put on that story on its front page was, We'll fight Islam for 100 years. So this is our national daily newspaper saying that we will fight Islam for 100 years. Now, obviously, this did not go unnoticed, and there were some small peaceful protests in two or three state capitals over the next few weeks, with multi-faith religious groups marching against this headline. Within a couple of days, on its online site, it had changed it to a more reasonable heading, which was, we'll fight radical Islam for 100 years. We could still have issues with that wording, but nevertheless, they'd put the word radical in there to distinguish that from the broader religion. a parody of that was carried as a banner by the protesting groups. And it was a parody of the masthead, a little bit like Honi Soa, the University of Sydney newspaper's done over the last couple of days, but its spoof masthead was The Welcoming Australian, and it was, the headline was, We'll Love Muslims for 100 Years, and that's what the multi-faith leaders, you know, Christian and Buddhist and Muslim leaders were carrying in their protests. But that stands out to me. I mean, there's many, many others, of course, in community newspapers with protests. Another one that springs to mind was from a US website, which actually foreshadowed an extreme protest by actually advertising where and when the protest would be by these populist extremists, which actually poured fuel on the flames of the likely violent protest that was about to be held. So they're just a couple of examples, Denise.
And what about you, Abdi? I know there's many examples, but what would be one that really sticks in your craw, so to speak?
I think one thing that's also problematic in the way Islam and Muslimism is reported is not actually using Muslims as a source of your reports and your writing. And I think that's a lot more common than the headline that Professor Beeson has just mentioned. What is very common is the lack of use of a Muslim source in the story. And that then creates a situation in which the voices of Muslims are actually absent from, say, a mosque protest story. So I think that is another area that there is negligent reporting, if not poor reporting.
And that's a very good point about sources, because you often read stories on these issues and there is no one from the community that is actually sometimes being demonised or even commented on or spoken about. So, Cod, I know you have views about that. Would you like to see more journalists reaching out to yourself and people within your community? You and I were part of the AusSud program at the University of Melbourne, where you helped train young African Australians, or Sudanese in this case it was, to actually deal with the media and have a voice in the media, because the media was not actually allowing a voice at that point.
Yep. Thank you, Denise. I think journalists will find it beneficial if you were to reach out and have connections with community members and community groups of various diverse groups like African or South Sudanese in actually being able to report effectively. And, you know, it does help in terms of being a mutual benefit for both parties. And, for example, even, you know, parties like Victoria Police members tend to find it beneficial if they were, first of all, to seek some understanding around certain issues before actually they go to the news conferences or speak to journalists and stuff like that. And I have, for example, yesterday I happened to receive a phone call from one community member. This is just an example that I want to say. And apparently I think there was an involuntary order for her to get taken to the hospital for psychiatric treatment. But she was paranoid, never wanted to help. The police was there, emergency services were there. And the situation could have turned quite ugly. So when I was speaking to the police member, for example, the police member was not quite understanding of what was happening. And having come from a prior experience where a situation like that escalated out of control and the person actually ended up injuring police members, and it was because of poor communication, language issues, and, you know, it went to the knees, I was able to quickly call, you know, one of the inspectors and arrange a phone conference during work hours, and it went on for about 45 minutes. Later on, that person complied and was taken to the hospital for treatment. Let's come to where the voices of the community, for example, with respect to that example, another example. For example, in recent times, we don't get consulted when there are comments to be made. And of recent times, for example, there have been a few journalists who have reached out to actually have the voice of the community. And what you tend to find is that when you have a balanced voice within the news that is being made out, it actually makes the story look better because you have sourced alternative views and members of the community have actually given thoughtful reflections as to what that reporting is and what the issue is. And it makes sense to the wider people who will be reaching or reading or probably listening to the news in a sense that there is a great understanding that is quite an eye-opening rather than probably maybe one-point reporting. And in a way, you know, a lot of African and South Sudanese community members are not well represented in the media, and probably maybe, you know, the media in itself is just probably maybe one mainstream Anglo-Saxon community, and there is no problem maybe that balanced reporting in a way. So reaching out and giving the community members that voice does help in a way significantly.
And the fact that some journalists aren't doing that at present is you have all personally witnessed as a journalist yourself and as people working in this area, just the sadness, the isolation, the sense of being the other that young Muslims and young African Australians can feel after a spate of negative media reports. So I'd like to ask you about that and also about the very extreme situation where occasionally someone feels so alienated, it can lead to radicalisation. We saw a story on the front page of The Age today regarding a successful program to help young people. So, Mark, perhaps if you could talk about that.
Yes, well, there are academic experts in this space, people who are experts in national security, psychology, and these areas. One of the most difficult things to ever prove in the communication and media space is what they call media effects. And it's always very difficult to prove that a certain type of media coverage or a certain type of medium, say a video game or something like that, has directly caused something to happen. And that it's always a difficult thing. So in our project, we do not claim that adverse media coverage causes radicalisation or terrorism incidents. However, the literature we've found has certainly found a link between adverse media coverage and people's feeling, you know, contributing to alienation and isolation in the community. So, from that basis, and another body of literature where radicalised people, experts and so on have been interviewed, another body of literature proves a link between alienation and isolation and radicalisation. So what you have is this, the media contributing to isolation and alienation, and then alienation and isolation contributing to radicalisation and, quite frankly, other mental health issues and things like that, not just joining terrorist groups. So whether there is that media link or not, it certainly ventures into that middle ground. What we do know, however, is that there's certainly many direct cases of rabid talkback radio hosts going on air and ranting against Muslims after some terrible incident in the news, and ordinary Muslims walking down the street and having tomatoes and cans and things thrown at them, abuse on buses and public transport and all the rest of it. So whether you can say that is directly caused by such a talkback radio host or not is, up for an academic study. But there's enough anecdotal evidence there. So I guess that alienation, isolation, if we can report the news fairly and accurately, not shy away from it, but be inclusive in other stories that are portraying communities in a positive light. If coverage of Muslims and other communities, multicultural coverage, can be a part of our mainstay rounds and mainstream media coverage and go-to sources in those sorts of communities that we can access routinely in feel-good stories as well as the big bad news events, then all of that would contribute to, I'd imagine, less of this alienation and isolation.
Yes, and I know, Abdi, you spoke at the workshop about that sense of some ignorant media conflating Islam with terrorism in a sort of really odd way. Perhaps you could talk about that.
Well, I think it comes back to Islam is a great religion with 1.62 billion people, and you don't want to live in a world where, most of those people are actually terrorists. That would be a very dangerous world to live. So Muslims are not terrorists. Islam is not a religion of terrorists. So we need to be actually very responsible in the way in which we cover stories of certain individuals that are actually engaged in criminal activity. So I was just trying to make the point that Islam as a religion is a great religion. It's a religion that advocates for peace and coexistence. And adverse media coverage can actually cause social divisions. It can undermine social cohesion. And so as a journalist, when you write your story, you need to actually have all that into consideration, that the way you report your story might actually either enhance social cohesion or create a division within the society.
And, Cod, I've never actually forgotten you telling me about how you helped organise a South Sudanese beauty pageant. Hundreds of people attended. It was a really beautiful event. It went really well. And then later in the evening, a young man with mental health issues had a machete in a park. The coverage was only about the young man and the machete in the park. And that amazing event and all the wonderful community work around it was lost. And I remember your consternation at the time. So perhaps you can talk about a little bit about how you felt over the years.
Yes, thank you. This was in 2012, a beauty pageant. It is an annual event that is normally organized. And, I don't know if any of you has ever been to that event, but it is really beautiful community enlightening event. And normally, a number of models, predominantly females, sometimes there are females, normally would put on a show and contest for catwalk and lots of other modeling and win at the end of the day, get a prize. It can be a car, it can be anything. And in 2012, it was organized and it was successful. And then there was an after party, which is often, given to the BIP sponsors. And when that event was on, obviously, as Denise has described it, one guy with significant psychiatric issues and also some mental health, and I think was drunk at the same time, just rock up and was causing a lot of problems. When the police came, he was not complying, and he was just on and about, assaulting people. And the aftermath of that event was just shocking because it was covered pretty much by all the major news outlets. And if you would recall pretty well, I think you recall it or you can go and Google it. And it was very horrible because sometimes it is actually very dispiriting to a lot of community volunteers and members who work hard in a way to help stage those activities so that we can promote our community in a positive light, as well as find a way to socialize with mainstream. For example, you and I will agree that there is a significant divide, although it doesn't actually get spoken quite a lot. But you tend to find that a lot of newly arriving communities are actually settling in the outskirts and fringes of Melbourne and in their own cocoons and their own parts of the world. A lot of the early established communities are either maybe within Melbourne or probably maybe within those. And there is a social divide. I mean, if you go into soccer clubs, within soccer clubs, they are set up along ethnic lines. You would find that is either a Greek or Italian or whatever Irish team. And all this social connection is being lost. And in trying to set up activities like beauty pageant to try and actually harmonize, if people have friends, you know, mix them up, people so that people can socialize, it becomes a different concept when the media cover it. And I think we had to actually foot it off for a year. We never did the following year, 2 years actually. And then we got it going after 2 years without doing it. And it has been going on successfully. But that is one example as to obviously how the knees can destroy a number of positive things just because one person never got it right or had issues.
And, Cod, I know you've done some wonderful work as a soccer coach, and that was a Greek team that invited you, the Sudanese young men, to join, and that's been a wonderful relationship between the two groups at Sunshine Heights. I guess I want to ask the panel now, what can the community do to help particularly Muslim youth and youth from different backgrounds in their quest to get a job and get a life, et cetera, here? And also, what can journalists do? I know you have some tips for that. And then once we've discussed that, we'll go to some questions from you all out there. Mark, what do you reckon?
As far as the what the community can do, I'll leave it to my fellow panellists to answer that. I'm not an expert in community affairs. You mentioned the tips. Within the project, we have two different types of tips for journalists reporting in this space. One is 10 points that are essentially journalism 101, but applied in the Islam and Muslim space, you know, fairness, accuracy, that kind of thing. The 10 questions that journalists might ask themselves when reporting Islam are 10 that I might just share with you now because they come from the international literature in this area. There were at least three big international projects similar to ours, one in Europe, one in the UK, and one in the US. And what we've gleaned from them is some similarities in approaches. They draw upon traditions of peace journalism, solutions journalism, inclusive journalism, mindful journalism. And so I'll just share you these key questions journalists might ask themselves. Number one, does my story distinguish between Islam as a religion and the radical philosophies that inspire extremists? Or does it conflate and confuse them? Number two, is the language carefully considered? Does it adopt an alienating tone that is emotive, immoderate, alarmist or abusive? Does it seek to avoid negative labels and stereotypes? Number three, does my story avoid an us and them dichotomy in its coverage? Number four, have I ensured my angle is evidence-based and checked I have not leapt to any assumptions based upon someone's name, religion or physical appearance? Number five, does my proposed angle make the basic error of portraying Islam and Muslims as a threat to national identity and a particular way of life? Number six, have I taken time to reflect carefully and self-critically upon this story, my purpose with it, my approaches to it, and the lives that it might affect? Number seven, have I reflected upon and identified my own views, prejudices, and positions on this topic? Number 8, does my research acknowledge the diversity of opinions and practices within Islam as a religion and between Muslim communities and avoid portraying a single Muslim position? Number 9, do I portray people as human beings or focus unreasonably on their membership of an ethnic or religious group? And number 10, are the images or vision accompanying the story appropriate and in context? And I hope from those you can see the level of reflection we're asking journalists to engage in when they're reporting on this very, very controversial space.
Abdi, then I might ask you about the community, what we can do as a community. In academic terms, they talk about social bridges, that sometimes they are not there and that communities, new communities, are in isolation or communities that are just ignored at times.
I think there are parallels between how the African community and the Muslim community is reported, especially the adverse and negative reporting side. I am both an African and a Muslim. I also came from Africa. And I think we need to actually report all the good things that happen in these communities, and that's not the case. And even when journalists actually go and try to report that festival, that's actually a reflection of balance. Because if we're always picking what is wrong with these communities and reporting that, but ignoring all the good stuff that's happening within that community, I think there is a lack of balance there. So there's a lot of good initiatives that the Muslim community is currently doing in a number of areas, including the youth. But also I think we need news organizations to actually also embrace young Muslims in their newsrooms and actually hire them, because they might actually bring a perspective of Islam and Muslims.
And Kot, I know you would be aware there it's the Africa Media Awards tonight, set up by Clyde Sharadi, who's a journalist who was annoyed at the lack of coverage of all the great things happening in your communities.
Precisely, and I will be heading off to that event shortly. What is happening is the reality. There is a significant need for bridging the gap in terms of the media coverage. And there are a number of good things, and I think, Africa Media Award is an annual award that is covered, and you will never find it anywhere making itself even to any particular page or even, 10 or, 100 words of it being written either in a newspaper or on a television or anything like that. And these are, this is an award ceremony that is going to acknowledge a number of community leaders and volunteers who work terribly, very, very hard to make Australia either a better place or help a lot of people who are struggling integrate. And, they do it for free. They don't do it for any paid work. And the government doesn't even pay them. Many of them pork money out of their own pockets. The other thing is, obviously, giving the community members voices. For example, in December, 10th of December, there is African Music Festival at Federation Square. It is a very big event, and we are on the panel. Yearly and annually, it costs nearly over $100,000. In terms of staging that event, providing foods and a lot of stuff. And, a lot of the time, there may be no coverage about the event in itself. And, the benefit of that and being able to showcase the culture and performances to a number of people who will be wandering and enjoying at Federation Square. And often, let's say if there is a single issue happening at that event, it is what is going to make more news as opposed to the benefits as to what that is bringing in terms of cross-culturally bridging the gap in terms of different cultures and showcasing our culture. So indeed, there is a need for bridging by gaining access. And one example, for example, that happened in June 2012 at a soccer club, Denise Ryan covered a news that made the front page of The Age at that time. And it was about a soccer club that I was the acting coach, and we were playing, and unfortunately, as we were winning the game, we were being racially taunted, being told, black monkeys, go back to your country, black cunts. And we resisted, and were playing. We were leading 2 goals up, and we kept keeping our head cool. And obviously, one boy just reacted to a female spectator who was just never stopping and said, "Shut up, bitch." And just that, the son was one of the players in the field, turned around and knocked him down. And we found ourselves in a situation where there were over 100 people just taking chairs and baseball bats, and we had to knock unconscious, and significant number of people, you know, sustaining injuries. As a result of that, you know, there was nowhere in terms of actually grieving our points of views and where we should put them. Denise courageously, you know, covered it, and it made the front page of the Herald Sun. And what happened as a result of that today is that the referees actually changed the way they handled the games, because this was a referee that we told to call off the game, you know, and I kept pressing him, you know, call off the game, this is going to be very, very ugly. Look at the home crowd, it is terrible. We cannot go on like this. He ignored everything. So these sorts of voices and these sorts of coverage as journalists, whether maybe be it small journalism or be it, you know, you are a journalist from a bigger major reporting news, do help sport on issues that are pressing very, very hard on those communities, as well as covering a lot of positive good that those communities are doing. And instead of having negative news all the time, that alienate and demonize and actually isolate more and more those communities as opposed to helping them be part of the wider Australian, and they all contribute in different positive ways.
Yes, I recall that story for the Age well, Cot. It was a very sad story because one young man was beaten unconscious, and when I followed up later, he hadn't played soccer again, which it was something that had kept him going in the refugee camps for years. To come to Australia, a young man who loved playing soccer, it was his passion, but following that incident, he didn't feel safe going back onto the soccer field. But
in fact, the whole team just quit altogether. That's at that time, because we never felt safe, because, you know, you go to play a sport, you could just end up dead, because that could have happened to those two young boys that day.
So, I mean, Cot contacted me about that story, and that's where journalists need to make those contacts within the communities to do the kind of reporting that I guess shows what's going on. As a result, Football Federation Victoria really looked at its practices and helped around racist sledging, and in a sense it was a dreadful story, but it had a positive outcome. I'm going to turn now to the audience for questions. I'd like to ask you, please, for no comments. You've got an expert panel, so please, questions.
Thank you very much to the Wheeler Centre and the panellists for taking part in this today. Much appreciated. Salaam alaikum. Look, I've read a number of things in the news and other places, and sometimes what you read is not true. Islam is not a mere religion. It is a way of life with rules and manners governing every facet of life. Amongst the facets of life that it governs includes the treatment of homosexuals. There was a man in Australia recently, Farouk Sekaleshvar, who was a preacher from Iran, I believe, who described how homosexuals have to die. Because that's the will of Allah.
Excuse me, sir, you have a question? Yeah.
Well, I'm asking whether what I've read is true. There is also the animal slaughter, halal slaughter, that the animal must be conscious when their throat is slit so that it can have the benefit of hearing the sacred prayer. Is this true? That dogs are deemed to be unclean. Is this true?
Okay. Abdi, I'll put that to you.
Okay, no, I think you've read a lot of stuff. I think there's a lot of other stuff that you could have read that actually was. But these are the points that people actually always speak on Muslims. So that's what it is. But Islam is a religion, just like Christianity is a religion. There are things that the religion tells you are permissible. There are foods that Islam tells you can eat. There are ways of slaughtering animals that's actually instructed by text. So I think I'll probably give that short comment. So a lot of the stuff that you've actually read is not something that I can actually tell you it's right. But there is always danger of reading everything and believing, and I think you're already skeptical about what you read. But yes, Islam has, is a as a religion, actually has instructions for its followers to actually do. So slaughtering animals, there are rituals that one must actually do. Whether or not that is something that everyone agrees is not actually important, because Muslims have to follow the Islamic religion. So as Christians must follow their religion.
I thought your comment in the workshop, Abdi, was really pertinent here. You mentioned that Islam is practiced in 183 countries, that there are about 700 different groups with different theological approaches. So there are no clear-cut responses to these questions in that sense.
Yeah, and that's true. And because, as I said in the workshop, the five pillars are actually the things that are most common to all Muslim sects and branches. Anything after that is actually, there are four different schools of thought. There is culture that's actually embedded into the Islamic religion. So even though two countries are also from the same school of thought, because one is a country in Africa, another one is a country in Asia, they might actually have cultural elements that were embedded into the religion. So that's why we say Islam looks Chinese when it's in China, and Islam looks African when it's in Africa. So it's a very, very complex religion because of it is very diverse.
All right, do we have another question from the audience?
What's the process now that you have this program in its third year in terms of getting it into universities for training journalists or getting it into workplaces at the moment? Have you had conversations with the media companies?
Mark, you might like to.
So throughout the second year where we were trialling and doing our initial training, we trained more than 200 journalists, students in small groups, journalists and students, and it was a mixture of training in newsrooms or newsroom-organised events, industry groups that had organised training, and also just straight university classes. We've broadened the types of training we can do for the third stage, and that can include things like having a small dinner or a meeting with regional journalists across media, because what we've tried to do, and we'll also be doing the university and newsroom training, but the difficulty we've encountered, and most of these sorts of projects encounter these difficulties, is that with modern media being so resource poor, having the resources and time so stretched, it's difficult to get more than, you know, an hour or so out of a newsroom, and even then a lot of the journalists can't come because they're doing other duties. It's easier, much easier, to get into university curricula, even though their curricula is quite full. Most of them are very accommodating to having a two-hour workshop in our topic area. So we're experimenting with other ways of at least getting the basic materials and the availability of the materials out to journalists, and we've also put it all online so that they can then go there after that. Inevitably, the irony is that once we get them for half an hour, and start doing the workshop, their feedback is always, oh, this was way too rushed. This should have taken so much more time, you know, that's the problem. It deserves the time, and once they're in there, they realise how important it is and how little they actually know in the space. But to get that time out of resource-poor newsrooms is very, very difficult.
I'm wondering if you have advice about how to reduce fear, because fear seems to be behind this, and whether sort of promoting cultural knowledge, food, all those sort of really interesting things that ordinary white middle-class Australians might be really interested in.
All right, perhaps, Colt, if we can start with you, and then, Abdi, if you could give your response to that one.
There is, I think, a need to probably maybe have, you know, an equivalent of train the trainer, you know, with respect, for example, to the African. And if people, for example, were to consult, I know there are a number of African leaders who are proactively active in the sector, and they'll be willing to put together anything and put together cost component or you know, a forum where this thing can happen on a regular basis, even quarterly or annually or whatever. Yes, I agree there is a need to promote that. The second element is obviously having, you know, media channels or outlets being able to, you know, be proactive in themselves, you know, through a higher chain of management to actually encourage journalists to interact with the broader community. And I think, for example, SBS and ABC are model reporters in this sector, because what we're realizing is that when there are needs or when there are issues, they are proactively engaging with the community before things happen, and when they happen, they already have connections and they give the community voices when, you know, these issues occur. So that should be the same. And also, you know, in modeling or putting together a component that can bridge all this gap is the universities as well should take leadership and lead, and other educating sectors, for example, like what we're doing today. This thing should happen in quite a regular basis, and, you know, people are willing to do whatever that can be done. Lastly, I think probably maybe there are also, you know, sometimes we don't have the list of people to invite when we have a lot of community events happening, and not necessarily happening in Sawson's community, but happening within the wider African community. And when these sorts of events happen and, you know, you are able to come, spare some time, even an hour, 2 hours, come and interact. And I've realized, for example, you know, Denise Ryan probably maybe enjoyed herself when I invited her in the inauguration party that we did in October last year, when and she probably maybe witnessed significant cultural dancing and a lot of, you know, cultural food and stuff, which I think will enrich her and probably maybe, you know, something that is an eye-opening for her. And I think this is the sort of thing that we need to do.
Yes, I agree. That was a fabulous event. Lots and lots of dancing, great food. Everyone needs to go to an event that COT organises, basically. Abdi, but about fear.
Yeah, I think I agree with COT. If you want to reduce fear, the Muslims, we have the National Mosque Open Day, and I think that was only 2 or 3 days back, where nationally all the mosques around the country were open to non-Muslims to come and experience what a mosque looks like, just so that you actually go inside and actually picture what a mosque is like, but also ask questions about Islam and the religion and all that. So I think that will probably create an environment in which you actually understand that most of these places of worship are not breeding grounds for terrorism or extremism. So I would encourage anyone here to actually take that opportunity, a mosque in their neighborhood, to go there and actually speak to the Muslims and actually ask the questions that you actually have.
And I might add that you don't need a national mosque open day to go to a local mosque. I've done that myself a few times now, and they're always very welcoming.
I live in Shepparton, which has got quite a large Muslim refugee community. I believe that the local media there is actually doing a very good job in telling the voices of the Muslim refugee community there. Yet many of the people from the Muslim community I speak to still feel quite isolated. They don't feel like they're welcomed into the community. They feel quite separate from the white Australians. And many of them I speak to don't identify themselves as Australians. What more can we do to help engender these people into the community? I believe the media's doing a good job as it is.
Who would like to answer that one, gentlemen?
I think it's interesting, because I think when we were doing our project, a part of this project was a very engaging consultation and conversation with the Muslim community. And it was the Muslim community that identified that we are not talking about the positive reporting, because the Muslim community acknowledges that there are a lot of journalists who actually do their job very well. And that's not acknowledged a lot. But it did not come from any other but the Muslims themselves. So I think that's a very good point. There is all journalists are actually not. We cannot box them all into one thing. A lot of them are actually doing responsible journalism work, and they have to be congratulated. For that Muslim community in your area, I think engagement is very important. That might not actually go become very easy initially, but I think ongoing engagement will help that community actually trust media and come and actually participate in your stories and give you an alternative to the story.
Thank you so much. And if you would like to contact anyone on the panel, Mark and Abdi are at Griffith University, Cott is at Slater and Gordon, I'm at Swinburne University, and perhaps we can continue the discussion online. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing, and ideas from Melbourne, Australia, and the world.